from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. It's long been thought that a lack of access to healthy food is one of the key reasons why many low-income families struggle with obesity. If you live in a so-called food desert, neighborhoods lacking a good grocery store, you're more likely to consume cheap, high-calorie food. But a recent study, which tracked the food habits of 5,000 Americans for 15 years, indicates that it's not that simple, that even when neighborhoods have access to better food, food consumption patterns don't necessarily change. You can lead a family to salad, it turns out, but you can't make them eat it. Ahead on Forum, we'll look at the complicated question of how we change what we eat. Our topic after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome to Forum. Where's your nearest supermarket? In San Francisco, about 85% of city residents live within a half mile of a full-service grocery store. But that pattern varies by neighborhood. As the Bay Guardian newspaper reported this week, just 63% of Bayview residents live that close to a market. In the Excelsior, it's just 57%. It's long been argued that if you solve that basic access to good food problem, you could make a real dent in America's obesity epidemic. But it turns out that the problem of what we eat is a lot more complicated than just where we shop. For 15 years, researchers tracked the food shopping habits of some 5,000 Americans in four American cities, including Oakland. Last summer, they reported their surprising findings. Better access to good food doesn't necessarily change food consumption habits. Even when neighborhoods have healthy alternatives, even when there's a fair food fight, so to speak, a burger and fries tends to trump fruits and veggies. That doesn't mean the solving of the so-called food desert problem isn't important. It just means that changing what we eat is a complicated question. And that's the one we're going to take up this morning in this first hour of Forum. Joining us, Lena Miller. She is co-founder and co-executive director of Hunters Point Family, which educates residents of that neighborhood about the health benefits of fresh, non-processed food. Lena Miller, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well is Christopher Cook. He is the author of the article I referenced in the beginning that appeared in this week's Bay Guardian, former city editor of that paper as well. His work has appeared in the LA Times, Harper's, and the Christian Science Monitor. And he's the author of Diet for a Dead Planet, Big Business and the Coming Food Crisis. Christopher Cook, good morning as well.
Hi, good morning, Dave.
And joining us by telephone is Dr. Cora Lewis. She is a professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Alabama's Birmingham School of Medicine and the Diabetes Research and Training Center. And she's one of the authors of the study I just referenced, Fast Food Restaurants and Food Stores. Dr. Lewis, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let me start with you, Dr. Lewis, and have us walk us through your findings, because it is sort of counterintuitive. The assumption is that if you had better access to food, that you'd solve, at least in part, this problem of what people eat. Your studies found that that wasn't necessarily the case. Walk us through, if you would, what your key findings were.
Well, we looked at a couple of different dietary effects, if you will. We looked at diet quality, and we looked at whether people were eating fruits and vegetables in quantities that would meet the dietary guidelines for Americans. And we looked at a couple of different measures of food availability. We looked at supermarket and grocery store availability, and we also looked at fast food outlets. Our study has been going on for a number of years. We started in 1985 in four centers, as you mentioned, including Oakland. So if any cardio participants in Oakland are listening, thank you very much for being in the study. And so we had the addresses of the participants' homes, and we were able to map these to supermarkets, different fast food outlets, and then follow them over time to see how their diet changed. And we could, when we would periodically contact them, you know, we could redo our our data in terms of where they were living and those types of things. So what we found were that in low-income men, fast food availability within a shorter distance from their home was related to a higher fast food intake. We did not find the same thing for women or higher income participants. And we found that supermarket and grocery store availability, again, close to the home, were generally unrelated to the dietary intake.
So it sounds like that fast food access has a real impact, that it is a kind of magnet in a way that good grocery stores are not?
Well, that could be one interpretation of what was actually going on. Our study, of course, is observational. So we were, you know, sort of looking at the state of nature, if you will. It wasn't an intervention study. So, you know, you have to be careful about, you know, assuming that, you know, one thing causes another. Although an advantage that we had a couple of advantages from other studies that have attempted to do this, is, you know, we have been following these participants, so we're not looking at a population level. We know a lot of things about the individuals who are in our study. Some of the studies in a similar area don't have as much individual level data as we do, and we followed people over time. And that gives us certain advantages as well. If you do a cross-sectional study where, you know, you're looking at one point in time, you can sometimes make inferences that don't end up being true if you had been able to follow changes over time.
Let me hold you with that thought for a moment, because I don't want to get too deep into the methodology of your findings, but I want to explore this fundamental question about whether or not what is going on, and let me ask you from your experience, Lena Miller, in Bayview Hunter's Point, about why this might be, that even if you have access to healthier food, that isn't enough in and of itself to change what it is that people eat.
Well, I think, first of all, we have to look at what is healthier food. I think that if you go into any, you know, if you look at, when you say good grocery stores, if you're talking about, I mean, what is a good grocery store? Is Safeway a good grocery store? I'm not picking on Safeway. It's just because they're one of the largest in San Francisco. But the majority of the food in there is highly processed, uses a lot of white foods, white salt, white sugar, white flour. A lot of very highly processed foods. And so when people don't really understand what good nutrition is. And basically it's very simple. Stick with what comes out of the ground in its most natural state that you can.
So in other words, it's not so much even perhaps where you shop as it is where you shop within the store. I mean, it's what aisles you go to, as opposed to necessarily, it's not just a question of having a good grocery store, quote unquote. It's what you do inside that store.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people, they've kind of bought into the mass almost belief system that good food is the kind that you see in the packages. And they're not really looking at what the quality of their food is. And again, the state of it. I think our entire body is still the same as it was, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago. But now everything that we're putting into it is poison, from the antibiotics and steroids in the animal products, to the nitrates in the lunch meats and so on and so forth, to the pesticides on the fruits and vegetables, to, again, the highly processed nature of sugars and flours.
Lena Miller, founder and co-executive director of the Hunter's Point Family Project, which educates residents about the health benefits of food, also works with at-risk, low-income young people in the Bayview-Hunters Point area. Chris Cook, as you've researched the article that you wrote and also the research that you did for your book, you really have to, in other words, part of what I'm learning is that it's not an easy question. It's not just, well, if we put a good store here, it's going to solve the problem. There's a lot that has to be done in terms of the education part of changing how people fundamentally look at food, let alone how they cook and consume it.
Absolutely. And I want to say, I mean, what Linda is talking about is so true in terms of, you know, our definition of what is good food. And, you know, while it's important when you have a crisis situation to get something, you know, a Safeway, anything in there that in a neighborhood that's going to provide some fresh produce along with all the other stuff that's on the shelves, that's not really the solution either, you know. And you have to look at the whole food system and not, I think it's important not just to focus on sort of individual behavior. You know, I mean, we do bear some responsibility for our choices, but those choices operate in a context. You know, what's sort of, I talk about a food infrastructure, you know, what's surrounding us in terms of food, you know, food and quote food, you know, whether it's the proliferation of fast food restaurants, the chain stores, the liquor stores with the convenience markets, and then the rare supermarket in Bayview Hunters Point. You know, and I went into the Foods Co. in that neighborhood, and, you know, you walk through just like a wall of junk food to get to, you know, the produce is way in the back. And, you know, aisles and aisles of, quote, cheap deals of, you know, as Lena's talking about, highly processed food, you know, cereals that are just larded with fats and sugars and all the rest.
And what are we learning, Lena Miller, about what can change that behavior so that people do aim for the produce aisle as opposed to the white flour aisle?
It's really education and a dramatic transformation of consciousness. I mean, what you find is that people really have no awareness about how damaging these foods are to them. And people have really, in the United States, and I would say particularly urban areas, they have really developed a dependence on white flour and a sense of fullness when they get it and can't really reach it without it. And it's almost like it is an addiction and very hard to get off of. So when you talk about what's an alternative to pasta, to white rice, to all of these things, brown rice, quinoa, these sorts of things. I mean, and really having to swap them out of your diet, you know, really permanently because the damage that these, you know, foods do to your system. And we're not even getting into, you know, fast foods, fried foods. We're just talking about basic foods. If you prepare them in a very basic way, are still very damaging. I think people just don't know, and they're doing the best they can to feed their families with what they have.
Dr. Lewis, as you've done your research in this area, I'm curious about if you could rank order for us what the most important factors are. If access to good food, I mean, clearly it's important. Obviously, you have to have access for starters, mm-hmm. but it sounds like that alone is clearly not enough, that you have to have these other educational efforts that Chris Cook and Lena Miller have been describing. Do you have a sense from the work that you've done as to what can tip the balance in the direction of people changing their actual food habits?
Oh, that's a very good question. And, you know, some of these old sayings are probably, as my mother would say, old sayings because they're true. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. That's sort of my personal belief. In the studies that we've been doing with intervention, you know, like we're actually doing a trial now to see what the long-term risks and benefits are of weight loss. And so that intervention is pretty detailed, and we attempt to teach our participants a lot of information, as your other guests have been talking about, in terms of knowledge, you know, what foods are best, what foods should you stay away from, how to shop in a grocery store. If you ask nutritionists, they'll probably tell you that you stay out of the middle. If you go to a supermarket, you go around the outside. Think about what's around the outside. It's the produce section, the dairy section, and the soft drinks and things like that are in the middle. But you also have to have a heavy component that's related to not only knowledge, but behavior, and tools on, you know, how to take the knowledge and apply it in daily life. You know, how to eat out, how to, you know, work with relapse. Let's say you've been doing very well on your diet and the holidays come around, you have several parties to go to. They all have food. You overeat. Instead of losing a couple of pounds 1 week, you gain five.
Well, let's pursue this question of personal behavior and personal responsibility for a moment, because this is where it can get a little tricky. And Chris Cook, when you think about this question, on the one hand, it would seem like, well, this is kind of obvious stuff. I mean, you know, we know what's good for us, although maybe you both would disagree with that. It seems on the one hand, it's not that complicated. And it does get into this question of, well, why can't people take responsibility for what they eat?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the answer is it is simple, but it's not now. I mean, the food industry, the supermarket industry, the fast food industry have created decades and decades and decades of dominance over the food infrastructure in terms of the presence out there of what's available. And again, it's no coincidence that the highly processed foods, the junk foods or almost junk foods are most visible in the supermarkets. And you do have to go out of your way to find the healthier foods. And I think that you know, it's important, again, to take a little bit of the focus off of the individual in the sense that we are dealing with, you know, in certain parts of the city and across the country, some people don't like the food deserts term because there are actual people and lives in these communities. It's not really a desert, but some people are calling them food swamps, where you've just got the junk food, the liquor stores, the fast food far outweighing any access to fresh produce. And so, you know, you have to consider that for 20 years, Bayview Hunters Point area didn't have a supermarket at all. And now in the past 2 or 3 years, or, you know, I don't know how long Foods Code's been there, but not that long, I don't think. You know, now they've got a couple of supermarkets, but it's not like these operate in isolation from people's reality.
Lena Miller, weigh in on this too, on the question of personal responsibility. Taking everything that Chris Cook said about that it hasn't been that long since Bayview Hunters Point has had a decent store, that there's obviously income reasons, cheap food. I mean, bad food is also cheaper. You can get more calories buying something cheap. So all of that is clearly part of the equation. But in the end, don't people have to take a certain responsibility too?
I think absolutely they do. I mean, the reality is we can say, you know, it's the food industry, it's this, it's that. But in the end, we're the ones, as individuals, we suffer. Our families suffer. And waiting for somebody else to, you know, change our reality is just not going to happen because it's not to their benefit. It's not to their advantage.
And what do you find that does do that? When you're working with young people, for example, in Bayview Hunters Point about educating them on these changes, what clicks?
I think it you know, it's a long process, and even for me it took almost a decade for it to really click, although I had the knowledge, because knowing something and doing something, particularly around food, is a major difference. But I think it's just putting I think our gardens really worked. It helped to have it click for a lot of our young people, seeing food actually growing out of the ground where at first.
You have three garden projects within Bayview Hunters Point.
Yes, certified organic community gardens in Bayview Hunters Point, and where our youth work. For most of the youth in the community, it's their first job. And for the first time, a lot of times they see food actually growing out of the ground and they taste it. And all the, you know, it's like when you taste a strawberry that comes right out of the ground versus one in the supermarket. It's, you know, the difference between night and day, or an apple. And I think that's the first thing, is realizing just, you know, the purity of food and how good it is when it comes in its most natural state. And then the message is, this is how you need to eat. This is where all the vitamins and minerals are. This is how food is supposed to be. And this is the way that you have to eat in order for it to really honor your body and be the best that you can be. Now, that's, you know, it's one thing to taste a few strawberries out of the garden when they're down there. It's another thing to drastically transform their entire diet. And I think you're absolutely right. Bad food is cheaper. And one of the biggest issues that we're dealing with in Bayview Hunters Point is poverty. And you do have to survive. And it's very difficult, unless you're really armed with a lot of knowledge, it's very difficult to shop and have good food. Like I tell all my young people all the time, please, whatever you do, when you buy animal products for your children and your homes, buy organic. It's a little more expensive, but it's so, so important.
But tough to make that choice if you have limited resources.
Absolutely.
And you've got hungry kids to feed.
Absolutely.
What in your research and your not only the article you wrote this past week, Chris Cook, but in the other research and work that you've done in this field, have you found about the inequities? Because we should paint that part of the picture as well, that within the city of San Francisco.
Yeah, so geographically, I think you might have mentioned it in the opener, but 63-64% of Bayview Runners Point residents live within a half mile of a grocery store, whereas it's 85% citywide. There are many neighborhoods that have 100% access, so there's a real gulf right there. Bayview Runners Point is not the only part of the city that has food access problems. You look at the Ocean View neighborhood, you look at Excelsior, Visitation Valley, also very serious problems with access to fresh food. Then you also look at, and I don't want to pick on Bayview Runners Point because, as Lynn is talking about, there's some great work going on there. People are getting active. People are doing gardening and other programs, and it's talked about in the article, and Lynn does this work. But, there are serious health crises coming out of a long-term problem of lack of access to fresh produce, not as the only factor, but as a chief factor. So diabetes, heart disease, cancer, obesity epidemic, which is not exclusive to Bayview, but, it's higher in these areas where fast food is more predominant and where there's less access to fresh produce.
And Dr. Lewis, is there a kind of, if not a one-to-one relationship, at least a direct correlation between these problems that Chris was describing as the consequence of what we eat, health problems like diabetes, with income?
Oh, sure. In this country, the low-income groups are those who are particularly have particular problems with a high prevalence of obesity, of diabetes, of hypertension, of those types of things. Other, less developed or rapidly developing countries, it's different. It's the higher income groups, who have more access to foods and more sedentary jobs. In those places, you will see more obesity and its consequences in higher income groups. We've gone through what's called the epidemiological transition, where our major health problems have changed quite a bit to chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease and diabetes. And as you go through that transformation, as your population, the types of jobs that people do, types of food markets that there are and the availability of foods, you see big changes also in the population groups that are particularly at risk for these kinds of chronic diseases.
So, and I'm going to hold you there because we're going to a break. When we come back, we'll take your calls on this question as well. If you're someone who's changed your dietary habits, how did you go about doing that? What made a difference to you? How are you contending with this issue? If you're someone who's living in a low-income neighborhood or is struggling with these questions, what is that like for you? What are the choices you have to make in your own families? We'd like your participation in our program. You can join us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, changing what we eat and how we go about making those choices. A study that came out last summer pointed out that it may not just be enough to make sure that people have access to good food, that even when there is access, that there's still a real problem with how people go about changing what it is they eat. So we're talking about the ways in which that process goes about. What is it that has to do with education? What is it that has to do with income? What is it that has to do with just making good choices once you're inside the grocery store? Chris Cook has written about this issue for the Bay Guardian. He joins us along with Lena Miller, who is the founder and co co-executive director of Hunters Point Family, which works on these issues, and Dr. Cora Lewis, a professor at the Department of Medicine at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, who was one of the authors of the study that I referenced. We'd like to hear from you as well. How have you gone about dealing with this issue? Have you been able to make changes? What are some of the challenges that you've confronted? 866-733-6786 is the number. Forum at kqed.org is our email address. Let's go first to Alexandra, who joins us in San Francisco. Alexandra, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm really, really excited about your program right now. I'm in my sixth week of a no-sugar challenge. My mom asked me to do it with her. I'm all about eating sugar. I love gummies. I love soda. And the first week was no like raw sugars, brown sugar, white sugar. Second week, no artificial sugars. Third week, no natural sweeteners like agave, molasses, honey. The fourth week, no white flour, white rice. The next week, no alcohol. I did it through the holidays, which kind of derailed me for a moment, but I have so much energy. I'm really excited. All my food labels are like six items now, all natural. I have energy. I eat tons of fruit. It's a blast. So I'm so excited that you're doing this program because it is so difficult to find food that, you know, isn't processed and doesn't have sugar added into it. It's in the ingredients. You have sugar. You have inverted sugar. Then you have molasses. I mean, it's everywhere, and it's so hard to get away from.
All right.
I have energy, and I've lost weight. I just had to share.
Okay, Alexandra, thanks. Thanks for telling us that story. It's interesting the way in which Alexandra put it, Lena Miller, as a kind of challenge that she took on. Is that a technique that you have tried and that you think works with younger people in particular?
Well, in my personal life, absolutely. But for the young people that we work with, I think more what we're trying to do is create a pervasive consciousness about it. I think maybe we need to look into the challenge part of it, but more just education all the time about what these things do to your body.
And to go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I think this also raises the issue. It's a macro level issue, but the farm bill and the sort of food policies that drive food production and also drive prices in the market, you know, that makes it so that, you know, the commodity, you know, I don't get to anyway, you know, the subsidies primarily make junk food, fast food, and processed food, the sort of quote cheap food, at least on the buying purchasing end, because it subsidizes it and makes it cheap for the corporations that dominate the food infrastructure, you know, like McDonald's and all the rest. And, you know, amazingly, it can be more expensive to get an organic apple than a bag of potato chips. Yeah. And that's just, you know, that's a very warped set of...
It is really interesting to sort of connect the dots back to something like farm bill and farm policy. But that's, I mean, can you sit down with kids in Bayview's Hunters Point and say, let's talk about the farm bill? I mean, is how do you get to that sort of big policy question, Lena Miller?
I think the most important thing for us is not getting to the big policy question, but to look at, again, it goes back to individual behaviors. I think in Bayview Hunters Point, not just around food, but with almost every single other issue, from violence to education, what we've become very clear about over the years is that the outside society doesn't necessarily have our best interests at heart. If we're waiting for someone to save us, we can just, you know, hold our breath and die, because it's not going to happen. We really have to take responsibility for ourselves, or, you know, we're just going to, you know, as we can see, our mortality rates are, you know, 10, 15 years less than anybody else's.
And I guess the other way around to think about it is that if the way to have a conversation about something that sounds arcane like the farm bill and farm policy is you start with a bag of potato chips, Chris Cook. I mean, if you start with, like, how did this come to be, that's how that sort of big policy picture can seem more real and relevant.
Yeah, and I don't think that removes personal responsibility or engagement at all. I don't think we want to just be sort of passive recipients of food. I think the issue is, you know, is this food as cheap as you think it is? You're eating, you know, fast food, hamburgers and fries every day or every other day, and all these chips and all this soda that seems so cheap and accessible, and look at the health issues that you personally might be dealing with. And that's not to blame you, but, you know, that's to say, let's look at what's out there. Let's look at the alternatives. Let's look at, you know, one of the people interviewed in my story was very direct about, you know, she's a food guardian and she works in the community trying to build knowledge about healthier foods, both on the grocery side and the customer side. And she works in the gardening as well. And she talked about her own personal struggles with weight and other issues that came out of that fast food diet. And she's changed.
And let's hear from some other people whose work is in this area and whose habits may have changed as well. Andrea joins us next in San Francisco. Andrea, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I think this is a fascinating panel. I work at UCSF, where we have an obesity clinic for children and adolescents. And so we're really seeing the downstream effects of poor nutrition, you know, food, lack of access to healthy foods and inactivity and so on. But what I worry about, and I think that, really commend the work that the people on the panel are doing, I worry about this issue of personal responsibility and how that's been misconstrued politically, because I think that in many sectors, the message really has become, you know, if you're fat, it's your fault. Mm-hmm. If you're unfit, it's your fault. And I really believe that that is holding up some very important policies that could be in place. If you look at, for instance, the fast food toy ban in San Francisco, how controversial that was. This message of personal responsibility makes it really difficult to get policies through that would make it easier for people to make healthy choices.
Andrea, thank you for the observation and that reminder. This gets into an interesting arena about whether or not the degree to which problems like this are questions of personal responsibility, and Chris Cook, the degree to which you should form certain policies, which get you into questions that some people would call, you know, the nanny state, and that you can't make laws about what you eat, for example.
Right. I mean, again, this is not creating a nanny state. It's not sort of getting the government into food. The government is already in food. The McDonald's the fast food toy ban, for instance, again, this fast food is cheap because of the policies that the government has already put in place to make the ingredients for that fast food so cheap.
But
and the fast food advertising campaigns as well. So I think that, you know, again, it's not about saying that we just sit back as passive consumers and we do nothing ourselves, but it's about saying what is the context that we're all in. And that our tax dollars right now finance a system that is profoundly unhealthy and environmentally unsustainable. And those same monies could be spent in a different way.
What would you like to see, Lena Miller, in terms of the role of government? And there's this bill before the state legislature right now, AB 581, called the California Healthy Food Financing Incentive – or Initiative, rather. And the idea is to try to get more access to good grocery stores in lower-income neighborhoods. Is that a direction government should really get engaged in, or does it come back to the kind of more personal work that you're doing in terms of educating individuals?
Well, just to clarify, I think the personal work, what I'm saying is that that's what we have to focus on now. We have to. We can't wait for anybody else to do it for us. The broader picture, yes, I think government, I mean, absolutely, they should take a role in that because they've taken a role in getting this country to the point where we're so unhealthy. What I would like to see is government doing the things that are right. I mean, I think there's no argument about the pesticides that are on fruits and vegetables. There's no argument about is organic animal products, you know, better for you or not. There's no argument about is white sugar or white flour healthy. I think it's very clear what's, you know, what is good for people's bodies and what's not. And I think that, you know, at some point the government has to look at or should be looking at, if they're interested in the quality of life and health of the people who live here, you know, how do we transform our policies to promote good health for our people in masses, they have, you know, bad health for our people.
Dr. Lewis, are you aware of whether it's in small pilot studies or initiatives in particular communities or states where a government initiative can make a difference and still encourage, I guess, personal responsibility? Do you have a sense of this question of personal responsibility versus government responsibility?
Well, you know, the obesity issue is it's a big, complicated thing. But I think if you take it back to smoking, and you all in California have done a lot there with, you know, government interventions with taxation and that sort of thing. So I think we're going to have to tackle this problem from both angles. And Chris was talking before about the farm subsidies and things that make certain foods cheaper than others. I think there's going to be a role for lots of different ways to tackle this problem if we're going to actually make headway on the obesity epidemic.
And back to our calls. Let's hear next from Storm in Oakland. Storm, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I operate a company in Oakland. It's called Delicious Nutritious, and what we do is we deliver nutritionally dense food to people. We take an interesting approach. I pay a lot of attention to the food economics issue. And what we find is in the United States, we spend about $1 trillion a year treating preventable diseases like cardiovascular disease and diabetes. That's really almost equal to the amount of money that we spend on food itself. And so the approach that we take is we sell our food in partnership with employers because the employers carry the burden of that health care cost. And so the employers are incentivized to have their employees eat the nutritious food that we deliver.
Storm, thanks. Thanks, and thanks for the work that you're doing. Some emails coming in on this topic as well. Jay writes, a simple availability of foods is not the only problem. Marketing works. No one is marketing simple, non-processed foods. Mark writes, if you look at the book The End of Overeating by Dr. David Kessler, he presents the science that shows that bad fats and bad salt and bad sugars in the same foods are actually more addictive than heroin and alcohol. Paul writes in, you guys are missing the point. Most people don't have the time. They can't cook. So fast food and something from a box are the only choice. That's an interesting point, Lena Miller. Is that part of your experience that some of this is a question of people don't really have the time to do with it, or they don't have the ability to cook, and so fast foods are their only choice?
No, I don't agree with that. I'm a single parent of two children. I run an organization out in Bayview Hunters Point that deals with just about everything under the sun. Now, I'm really strapped for time. But I made the decision about 5 years ago when a close friend of mine was dying of stomach cancer. And that's when I began to really open my eyes. Then I decided I want to be a bodybuilder, which opened up the whole another chapter about eating right. But it's not so much a matter of time. You can make good food really quickly. It's more a matter of knowing how to make it taste good. That's really what the trick is. I think most people's taste buds aren't adjusted to things like quinoa and brown rice and vegetables and don't really know how to cook or prepare vegetables in a way that tastes good and that their children would also like, particularly if they've already adjusted themselves to the other diet.
So I'm sitting here wanting you to do a cookbook. I think maybe that should be the next project for Hunter's family.
Well, I don't know that to say that I have mastered it, but I'm certainly trying. And I think there's a lot of cookbooks. And one of the things that, and I'm not plugging this, but one of the things that really helped me look at things differently is once I decide I want to be a bodybuilder, which I'm not there yet. But Oxygen Magazine, which is for women, and it really focuses every article about, what foods to select, what foods not to, and gives recipes. I think there's a lot of information that's already out there that people can use if you just, and again, the closer it is to its natural state, that's your indicator. Is it good? And I, so.
It sounds in some ways, Chris Cook, like we know a lot about how to do this. It reminds me of like the Alice Waters work that she's done in Berkeley, having a garden at a middle school in her community. I mean, it's not in that way. It's pretty straightforward.
Sure. I mean, it's not rocket science to think about getting fresh whole foods with small h. But I mean, again, if you look around you, and people are busy, and it's not to make excuses. I think it's more of an explanation than an excuse to say, not everybody is going to take as much proactive engagement as Lena's taking. And, we have to look around at the income issues as well that really drive the system, the situation. So, like, for instance, in Bayview Hunters Point, poverty rates and unemployment rates are roughly double the citywide averages, like literally double the citywide averages for poverty and unemployment. I mean, it's astounding.
And the number of people in the city overall, as you noted in your article, who have to rely on the San Francisco Food Bank for a regular source of their diet is like 100,000 people a month. Yeah. It's more the norm almost than not.
Yeah, and that's doubled since 2006, the number of people who are relying on the food bank now. You look at, you know, 48 almost 49 million Americans who are defined as food insecure, meaning they don't have a daily reliable source of food. You look at low-income seniors in the city as well, who are often socially, geographically isolated, who don't get the kinds of food assistance that they could be getting. So there's some very serious issues here with food access.
And to Amanda, next in Burlingame. Amanda, go ahead.
Hi there. One of the things I'm not hearing you guys say is the issue of the fact that companies are engineering foods to become addictable to us, to become addictive to us. And I think that's a real problem, is that our children are becoming addicted to foods and really don't know any alternatives. But what I had called to tell you was that I was diagnosed with breast cancer 4.5 years ago, and I'm a young person. It came out of nowhere. I had no genetic predisposition towards it, and I really sort of was like Alice going down the rabbit hole and realizing how much of an effect food has on my outcome. I had to, within, you know, weeks, completely sort of read up on all this stuff and make connections and then just revamp my diet. And, you know, mine was late stage and it was very frightening, but I don't think most Americans know how much, I mean, it's a double digit percentage of cancers can be prevented through diet alone. I did not have a good outcome. And here I am 4.5 years later. I mean, we eat very, very differently than we used to. I didn't know. I'm an educated person. I did not know about the damage that sugar can do, about the damage that lots of things can do. And, you know, my friends want help. And I think the key for me, I had to do it overnight because I was sick and I just didn't want to die. I had two little kids. But I tell my friends, you know, start with one thing at a time and just kind of work your way towards a lifestyle that is different. And we're living in this virtual reality where in the past, you know, ice cream had 4 ingredients. Now, if you go into any ice cream store and ask for the ingredient list, it's got 12 lines and 48 ingredients. Now, that is not ice cream, and you're not going to recognize most of the things on that list. That is virtual reality. We have to realize what is real food and what is not real food and make that distinction for people. I don't think people realize that 90% of the stuff they're eating is not real food.
Amanda, thank you, and thanks for your story. And it's terrific that you've been able to make the changes that you have and that you are doing as well as you are. Dr. Lewis, let me ask you to comment, if you would, on the comment that Amanda made and that was also referenced by the person who emailed in about that sugar and salt is more addictive than even certain kinds of substances like alcohol or other drugs. Can you validate that? I mean, are sugars that addictive?
Ooh, that's a very good question, a bit outside of my personal area of expertise, although, you know, there is information out about that. If you eat a lot of sugar, there's an insulin response. Your blood sugar will go up and then rapidly fall, and you'll crave, you know, sugar. So there is some validity behind that. That is true.
Dr. Cora Lewis, she's professor of medicine at the Department of Medicine, University of Alabama, Birmingham School of Medicine. Let's go back to take more of our calls. Miyoko joins us next from San Anselmo. Miyoko, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm actually a vegan chef, cookbook author, and cooking instructor. I'm actually on my way right now to teach a class for the McDougal program where we teach people from all over the country how to eat properly, to eat a plant-based diet. But I used to live in the Bayview, and I knew a lot of kids, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the responsibility of education, and I'm talking about formal education schools. And schools, a lot of the kids that live in the Bayview or in other poverty-stricken places around the country are part of the free or reduced school lunch program, and the nationally funded school lunch program utilizes a lot of subsidies, so it's a lot cheaper to serve chicken McNuggets than it is to serve fruits and vegetables. I've talked to nutrition directors at various schools where they say, well, even outside of the school lunch program, they have to sell chips because that's where they make their profits. So there is a responsibility that I think schools should be taking, and I know the SSUSD is doing a lot, to improve their lunch program and other schools as well, too. But nationally, overall, I would say it's a nightmare. And that's where kids are first oftentimes exposed. They go to school and they think, well, you know, they're serving pizza and McNuggets at school. It must be okay for me.
Yeah, Miyoko,
so
thanks.
I wanted to find out what your speakers have to say about that.
Useful point. Linda Miller, a comment on that?
I think she's absolutely right. I mean, the food that they serve in the lunch program is horrible. Not only that, it tastes horrible. And so, again, you're indoctrinating children at a very early age that this is okay. It's okay to eat like this, and it's being given to you by folks that you're kind of supposed to trust for your education and shaping of children. And I think just in general in this country, there's just such a lack of awareness and commitment to making sure that, you know, our first need is met, and our first human being's first need is food. You know, on Maslow's, you know, hierarchy of need, it's food. And the fact that instead of really we're eating poison disguised as food. And the reason why I say poison is because when this stuff comes into our body in all these different forms, whether it be the pesticides again or the hormones and steroids and chemicals. Every time that stuff goes into our bodies, it's attacking some part of our system or maybe all of it. And then we get a little bit of energy, maybe from the starch in it. And so we feel like, okay, we can go on. But slowly, 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 this stuff is damaging our entire system. And so I think, you know, from little children, and it's gotten worse and worse over the years. When I first started the agency in 1998, most of the kids had regular body forms. Today, the majority of, and 14 years later, the body shapes of the children, exact same living conditions, exact same addresses, whatever, have very different body shapes. And I think that is a very scary thing.
Anne in San Francisco has our next comment. Anne, go ahead.
Yeah, I take advantage of the food bank, and I am very low income. And I can tell you that the food that is offered for people that are poor through the food bank, there is an occasional green item, but most of it is starches and lots of potatoes. You can get onions and occasionally celery and some fruits and some canned goods. And if there is items that they have that are prepackaged, almost all of them are sugar or pasta, white flour, and being in the food desert, I can tell you that, you know, access to green vegetables is very, very difficult because of the expense. And a lot of people have a hard time just, you know, buying some kale or some bok choy and then, you know, figuring out what to do with it.
And thank you. Yeah, no, thank you for making that observation. Chris Cook, as you've looked into what food banks offer and other sorts of services, is there an effort to try to supplement what's on the shelves, as Anne was describing, with things that are more healthy?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I think that I would trust her experience, and that is still the norm in most food banks across this country, is that it's mostly canned and processed and packaged foods. But there is an awareness at the local food bank and other food banks in the Bay Area, I know, about getting more farm fresh produce into the mix. That's not to excuse the caller's experience in any respect at all. I want to also just reinforce or echo something that Lena was talking about. I mean, if you look at the school lunch programs, which again, there are solutions and there are pilot programs. People are trying to bring some of the local produce, some of the organic produce. They're trying to develop a central kitchen back in the schools instead of just reheating this really highly processed fatty food. The problem is almost always money. And, you know, to take it out of the individual responsibility, what about the responsibility of the government and the fast food industry and these corporations to pay their share to make these kinds of things possible?
It's so interesting because there's so many interesting connections to this. Rami writes in, I'm curious about your guest recommendations on what you should put into those food donation barrels in my grocery store. I know they don't want fresh food, but what should I put in? And I over Thanksgiving weekend, I remember, you know, buying a bunch of canned soup and putting it in the food barrel. Probably not the right thing to put in, right, Lena Miller? I mean, there's so many ways in which this all connects.
I mean, I think we go back again to why do our grocery stores look like this? Why do the free lunch programs look like this? Because this food is cheap. It's easy to transport. It's easy to get on the shelves. It has a long shelf life. And a lot of, you know, people feel like, okay, well, beggars can't be choosy. It's free. I'm donating it. And I mean, I think that, again, you can put in brown rice. You can put in some quinoa, even, you know, canned kidney beans, or, you know, there are ways that you can do things to make, you know, healthier choices. And I would think that the person who's donating should look at the label and say, what would I like to eat? What would be acceptable to me? What do I think is healthy? And make that choices based on what would you want for you and your family if you were the recipient of that food.
Just get a couple of quick last comments and we'll use this email as a jumping off point. Your program is interesting, but the entire food debate is stalled because as a society, we've stopped trying to collectively put something in place for our own good. We need an Occupy Food movement. So, Chris Cook.
Well, I mean, I just read an op-ed actually called Occupy Big Food. absolutely. I mean, again, it really stems from the policies that our tax dollars are currently investing in a highly destructive food system that is based on pesticides, large-scale corporate farming, and monocultures. 75% of the money going to 10% of the farms. And these are, again, mostly producing raw ingredients for the fast food business. So we need a very clear-minded, intellectually honest and courageous look at the upcoming farm bill and how that connects with people's lives right on the ground.
And a last thought from you, Lena Miller, that has to also always be combined with education and with people taking responsibility for the choices they make.
I think absolutely yes, and that's not to say that government doesn't have a role. It's absolutely to say government has a role, but it is to say that you're the one living in your body. And if you don't take responsibility for that, then, you know, you'll be waiting a long time for government to catch up to what's right for you.
Lena Miller, founder and co-executive director of Hunters Point Family. She joined us along with Dr. Cora Lewis in the Department of Medicine at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and Chris Cook, author and reporter for The Bay Guardian here in San Francisco. Thanks all very much. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.